Welcome to part 4 of the KAI Foundation 5 podcast series, our 5-part introduction to building better teams and great leaders with the Curtin Adaption Innovation Theory and its supporting inventory. KAI is the world's foremost measure for problem-solving style. It's used widely to create cohesive and productive teams and effective leaders. It's been in use for over 40 years and is supported by a large body of academic research from around the world. In these 5 podcasts, we want to provide you with an understanding of why KAI is so effective, so powerful, and indeed life-changing for many teams and team leaders. As Curtin himself said, the better I know myself, the more I can help others. Today's 4th part is entitled, Welcome to the Land of Getting Things Done. The creative adapters, and in it we are going to be looking specifically at the role and effectiveness of the leaders and team members on the more adaptive end of the KAI inventory, and how vital, but often unrecognized, they are in achieving the goals of teams and organizations. My name is Dave Harris, and joining me from across the Atlantic, I have 2 very distinguished guests to help us understand the role of adaptors. Dr. Ewan Jenkins is a Toronto-based KAI certified coach and describes himself as a practitioner of the practical. He understands cognitive theory and complex systems science, but more importantly, he also knows how to make that theory applicable in today's business world. In his own words, he turns potential into profit. Dr. Eric Kaufman is a dedicated leadership educator and scholar. The focus of his work is collegiate leadership education and leadership development with adults in community and volunteer settings. He is Professor of Leadership Studies at Virginia Tech and a certified practitioner of KAI. So thank you both very much for joining me. I wonder if I could turn to you first, Ewan. In episode 3, where we were looking at innovators, we talked about the paradox of structure. I wonder if you could refresh our listeners as to what the paradox of structure is and how that applies to people on the more adaptive end of the scale.
Thank you, Dave. Well, Curtin refers to the paradox of structure as structure is both enabling and limiting at the same time. And those who have a preference for solving problems creatively through adaption, they prefer to use the structure to the greatest benefit, but the downside is they sometimes stay in the structure too long. Innovators, they tend to want to destroy structure, to break it, think outside of the box is the colloquial term, but sometimes they abandon the structures too early. And so today we're going to be focusing on how creative adapters solve their problems using structures and what to do when they come up against structures that aren't useful.
Okay, well, if I could turn to Eric. Eric, perhaps you could tell us what exactly is a creative adapter?
Yeah, I think from the standpoint of someone who is more on the adaptive end of the scale, I really appreciate sort of surfacing some of the structure that I think that it exists and looking for ways that through sort of smaller changes in structure, being sort of intentional about, what changes we might make, we can really make progress and advance our problem-solving process. And so their creativity at times looks a little bit differently because it really takes an approach of really assessing the current scenario and what are the small changes that are going to have the most benefit, as opposed to sort of dismissing, the current what we currently know about it, and really looking to jump further away from our existing structure and culture.
Okay, well, I'm really keen, as you've told us, you're on the slightly more adaptive end of the scale. I'd love to hear later on some examples of your own experience of that, and obviously your role as a leadership educator. You're obviously going to have some great examples for us, I'm sure. But I wonder if we could just turn to the issue of solving problems and what that means to a creative adapter as opposed to an innovator.
I think one of the issues is that the problem-solving process sometimes is devoid of awareness of structure and limitations. And so on a more adaptive end of the scale, being this creative adapter, I end up looking for where the structure can be really helpful. sometimes it's a matter of communicating and sort of surfacing what that structure looks like, where there are some sort of boundaries, edges that we need to be paying attention to, and where we need to expand those or where we need to work within that existing structure in order to solve a problem at hand.
And Ewan, from your point of view, this business of how you approach a problem, how you look at a problem, how you consider problems, is that very different when you're on the innovative end of the scale, you know, in terms of how, what you're seeing, what you perceive, what's in front of you when you're faced with a problem?
Yes, let's contrast the two then, and let's see how adapters look at a problem and then how innovators look at a problem, because you'll be able to see then how sometimes the different approaches clash, they're antithesis to each other. So an adapter would always look to say, if they have a problem, what's been successful in the past, what can we learn, and how can we improve based on past experience. Normally then things work, it's low risk. Innovators, their first intuition then is to dismiss anything that's been in the past, because we are always seeking novelty or always looking for a more radical approach, even if in the short term those approaches aren't successful. So one prefers success and risk minimization, the other one is stimulated by risk and is looking for novelty.
Eric, is that from your point of view as an adapter, is that a good summary of the different problems?
Yeah, I think as on the more adaptive side, I do tend to be a little more risk averse. The one thing I would be cautious about is framing it solely in, you know, looking only what worked in the past. I think there is a desire to preserve what worked in the past and really to make sure that we're not sort of throwing out the baby with the bathwater, that sort of analogy, that we maintain the things that are working well and really take more of an approach where we sort of hone in on the small opportunity for improvement. Sometimes they can be larger opportunities, but I really see my role and approach as one that's much more focused on a continuous improvement process. I'm always looking for ways to make things better. So I am looking towards the future, but it's in a way that preserves a lot of the good things that we've already experienced in the past.
And if I could just add to what Eric said about the adaption preference for making things better, that's distinguished by the innovator's preference for making things different. So one focuses on being better, the other focuses on being different, and obviously we're looking for a combination of the two to actually make some radical change that actually works.
So Ewan, what would you say are the benefits of this approach by the creative adapters?
Well, the primary benefit is, in the short term, things work. And there are certain types of problems, certain types of roles, which lend themselves to more and a more adaptive approach. For example, if you are flying from London to New York, your preference is always to have, for me anyway, if I'm on the plane, a more adaptive pilot. I don't want the pilot at 36,000 feet saying, I wonder what happens if I pull this lever. And I can give you a very personal example that I had brain surgery at one time, and I had a choice of two surgeons. I actually used the KAI theory to decide which of the surgeons to go for, everything else being equal, because I don't mind a surgeon experimenting with somebody else's brain, but I'd rather have a surgeon have a low-risk approach, a more adaptive approach to solving my particular problem when it's high risk.
That's a very good example, Ewan. I must remember that if I ever have to choose a surgeon. Eric, tell me about your more personal experience of being an adaptive leader and problem solver. Can you give us some examples of how that actually has worked for you in practice?
Yeah, I think on my end, I end up taking an approach that maybe is a little bit slower and maybe not as obvious up front in the way that I go about creative tasks and problem solving. As a result, sometimes that doesn't surface me as the leader of the group. I do tend to at times sort of work in the background and sort of consider how we can take other ideas that have surfaced and make them better. In some ways, I do sort of think of myself as a perfectionist, always looking to sort of improve upon something. And so in business terms, I might connect that with this notion of total quality management, which was popular for a period of time. But I try to do it in a way that brings other people on board. It's not sort of an independent relying only on my own ideas, but really saying, how can we take several ideas, bring them together and have the best possible outcome?
And is it almost like a, you know, you have the ability to sort of pick and mix? You can kind of look at all the good ideas that have worked for you or for others, people that you know or people you've read about, and then you kind of take those ideas and try and adapt them for your own purposes.
Certainly. And that's what I'm trying to do. I don't rely on sort of my own intellect, but I do take sort of a deliberative process. Sometimes I might call it sort of a sense-making process where I need some time and space in order to sort of process different ideas and consider different perspectives. But it's not something where I'm relying independently upon my own idea generation, but instead I'm trying to sort out, you know, where can we take different existing ideas and really improve them in a way that advances whatever the goal is.
And tell me about your approach to rules as well, before we leave this subject. Do you see rules as a sort of thing that must be followed, or can you be a little bit flexible around them when you need to be?
Yeah, rules are a challenge for me. There are times when there are unspoken rules, and I really prefer to have those clarified and just be upfront. What is the rule? What exactly that is? I don't like to break rules necessarily. I'm really cautious about that. And so there may be times where someone needs to clarify and sort of give me permission to break the rules. That can be sort of a limiting factor in the problem-solving process, where to me, it's really important to know what are the rules and not be dismissive of that, where someone on the more innovative side could care less because it's not sort of an initial problem to worry about what the rules are. They'll come up with grand ideas and then figure out later, do they fit within the rules, where I take sort of the inverse approach.
And I know you mentioned before we came on air a lovely example with a children's playground near you, where a sort of kind of more strict interpretation of the rules actually helped. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it was really fascinating to me. This is a elementary school near my home, a place where my own children went to. And they've got a playground that's bounded by a street and some tree lines. And that has existed for a period of time. And so I imagine the scenario was that there were teachers that said, you know, sort of stay away from the street, stay away from the edges of the playground. But it was really unclear, perhaps, how far to stay away. And so what you found is students at the school were clustered very close to the playground equipment, really in some ways not taking advantage of the whole playground. They installed a fence around the playground, and that really opened up space in the playground for these children to really play and create in a way that they didn't before. And the awareness of the clarity of that edge, that fence, really opened up opportunities that didn't exist before. And so in many ways, I really see that as a great example of how structure really is enabling and really sort of building on that idea of paradox of structure, because it creates opportunities that perhaps otherwise people were unsure of or shied away from.
So Ewan, that's a great example, isn't it, that Eric just gave us, where the physical imposition of the rule in the form of a fence actually appeared to help everybody take more advantage of the situation they were in this case, using the whole playground.
Well, I mean, this is one of the key things, is structures actually are enabling. And as we will discuss shortly, without structures, innovators wouldn't have a platform to be able to exhibit their version of creativity.
I'd be dying to ask you, Ewan, to give me some examples of famous creative adapters. I wonder, could you give us a few so we've got some exemplars to go on before we move on to the next bit of the discussion?
Yes, although there's a word of caution here, because as we were hearing earlier from Eric tends to want to have time to reflect. He probably wants to have discussions with a group, because adapters are much more orientated to working within a group, coming up with a group solution, than innovators who always want to hog the limelight, particularly successful innovators, because they see themselves as mavericks. And as a result of that, then, the number of high-profile creative adapters are fewer than you may say about high innovators in the more recent times anyway. But they do exist. They do exist. And they have had a huge influence on the way the world operates today. So I've got three examples for you. And the first is Thomas Edison, who famously said that genius is 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. And most innovators would be thinking that it's the inverse. For them, it is 1% perspiration and 99% inspiration from the muse. That's what drives their light bulbs going on. But we know the world now is an Edison world. It's not his innovative rival, Tesla. Another example then is Marie Curie, who was fastidious in terms of her research in a very organized way. And she was also the first woman to become a Nobel Prize winner, first person to win two Nobel Prizes in different disciplines. And then the third more contemporary example then is Tim Cook, very detailed orientated. And in fact, you could say when he was brought in by Steve Jobs in the late 90s into Apple, he actually saved Apple because thanks to him, there were processes put in place to improve cash flow, improve productivity, which allowed Apple to survive and then be able then to deliver the more innovative vision of Jobs.
Well, I would agree with what Ewan had offered, noting that often the more creative adapters end up being sort of overlooked. And in fact, we've got a recent book, Jim Collins in his book, Good to Great, sort of noted that these level five leaders that surfaced in leading great companies often were not in the news. They were not people that someone recognized their name right offhand, but they were able to make changes and improvements to the organization that really allowed them to be successful. So I think that is common. I think, for me personally, Abraham Lincoln is a great example. And that may surprise some people thinking about the changes that Abraham Lincoln brought about, but he really brought people together. And I think a creative adapter is someone who is going to sort of bring people together. And so his focus on sort of maintaining the structure of the union in the United States, I think really was something that was a priority for him. He certainly worked hard, invested heavily, but he worked through the existing structure. Personally, he had thoughts about slavery and why that needed to change early on, well before he was in politics, but he decided it was really important to work through the structure, eventually working through a constitutional amendment rather than just sort of dictating and coercing people to change, but sort of recognize we have a structure, and if we can work within that structure, great things can come about.
Ewan, I want to ask you a little bit about the teamwork aspect of this now, and whether you think the innovators could actually, operate at all without the adapters alongside them in the team.
Well, if you ask innovators, they will say that they could survive just fine and dandy by themselves, thank you. But in fact, as Curtin would say, nothing kills innovation faster than too much innovation. You're always looking to do things differently, and in the end, if it's an enterprise, you may have spectacular growth, but you will crash because you don't have any cash coming in because you're not sending out the invoices. So in fact, if you look at all the successful organizations, behind every successful innovator, there's an adapter. In fact, going back to even to Marie Curie, the reverse shows that behind every successful adapter, there's an innovator. And her husband was actually a very high innovator. So innovative, in fact, that when he crossed the road, he looked the wrong way and was knocked over by a horse and cart and killed. So there are costs to being high innovators, and one of them is if you ignore adapters, your ideas will never see the light of day.
And I wonder, Eric, what you think about this fact that the innovators seem to grab all the limelight and indeed have kind of taken the word creativity for themselves. I mean, we're talking about creative adapters today, trying to redress that balance, because clearly adapters are creative, but people think that innovators are the creative ones, don't they? I mean, that's a common misconception.
Yeah, and I'm really cautious about moving forward this idea that the adapters are only in a supportive role. I think in many cases they do a great job supporting someone who's on the more innovative side, but I think there's also a lack of recognition of when someone on the more adaptive end really has been creative. And I would say I've been guilty of it on my own. I don't tend to see the things that I surface as something that's highly creative, even when sometimes other people recognize it. When I applied for my position here at Virginia Tech, I was really interested in the position. And so I took sort of ideas that I'd seen other people use, sort of creating sort of portfolios or things, and really set up a document that aligned how I fit with the position and had copies available to share with people. In my view, I just made some small improvements to what I'd seen other people do. But other people who had actually been in, even in some of the same sort of interviews that I'd been in the past, said they'd never seen anything like it. It was very different. And so I hadn't recognized it as something being creative, but I think it was. And so one of the challenges is that the creative adapters, we often don't even recognize our own contributions as being highly creative. And so if we're not voicing, you know, how great this idea is, then it does diminish the awareness and the popularity, you know, of the adaptive side of creativity.
So Ewan, why, I'll ask you the same question. I mean, why have innovators been allowed to get away with stealing the limelight like this?
Well, I think in more modern times, it's because innovators tend to be more individual than they are group associated. And our society then tends to be looking for exemplars around individual performance, particularly in the West. But there are lots of examples that show how, sometimes in quite quiet ways, adapters are creating structures, not just improving existing structures, but creating new structures upon which then innovators can flourish. And I'll give you two examples. First of which is around Gregorian chants. Pope Gregory in the 11th century or so, the Catholic Church at the time started to have six or seven Gregorian chants, sometimes more. And because there was no musical notation at the time, it would take a novice, sometimes a couple of years, to learn a chant. And then the novice then would go out to the parts of the Catholic world and then start to teach others locally. So you can imagine now, he may learn the chant in C major, but with the passage of time, as he was then moved over to the west coast of Ireland to teach the locals how to sing these Gregorian chants, that C major may have transposed to D major. And so there you have completely different chants on the west coast of Ireland versus the center of Rome. And what Guido d'Arezzo did is he invented what we now recognize as modern musical notation, staves, notes, and so on. And by using that structure, he was able then to not only capture the existing chants, but making sure that they were produced to a particular standard, and greatly reduce the amount of time it would take for a novice to learn these chants. As time has gone on, we have people like Bach, we have Mozart, we have the great composers, we have Lennon and McCartney, all of whom are using this structure to create in a more innovative way a musical representation of the way that they see the world and the message they want to communicate. The second example is going back to Edison. That the electricity that we have now distributed to most of the homes and businesses across the world are based on Edison's model of propagating electricity. And all the cell phones, all the electronic devices, the innovative electronic devices that we have now are based on the fact that we actually can have adaptive electricity at low cost at scale.
So Eric, tell me about the downsides of being a creative adapter, if indeed you think there are any.
Well, I do think at times working with innovators can be a downside because they can really stress us out. We're really trying to work within the bounds that we've been presented, and the innovators continue to sort of work outside of those rules. And so that can be a challenge. But I think there are times where it is really important to think beyond the existing structure and the rules. And I think the creative adapters can get there, but it takes a little bit more time. As an example, I'm working with a local group here in my community, serving in a leadership role, and we have this massive committee structure. And it has existed for a long period of time. I'm looking for ways that we can sort of remove some of that structure in favor of something that's more positive, but it's a little bit slower process and it takes some work to do that. And so being on the more adaptive side, what I'm looking for is what's the next structure to jump to before I sort of announce that we're going to remove structure. And so sometimes that's a slower process. And at times can be frustrating for someone who sees the need for change. And, you know, to sort of wait and be patient, I think can be a challenge. I also do feel like it sometimes we're looking to others for ideas and at times not even giving ourselves enough credit, you know, for what ideas we might have. And so I think that's really important to sort of not be so dependent upon others. I think there are scenarios where someone who is more on the adaptive side and looking for structure can be really creative with the existing structure, but there may be a tendency to rely on others a little bit more so than might be necessary in certain circumstances.
Ewan, before we wrap up this episode, I wonder whether you could talk a little bit about what innovators can do to make the most of their more adaptive colleagues and whether you've, you know, have you got some hints and tips for the frustrated innovator?
I think there are mechanical activities that individuals can do to make the most of their adaptive colleagues, but I think the biggest impact you could have in terms of working with adapters for greatest mutual benefit is to have a mindset shift. And when you think about adapters, stick the word creative in front of that label so that you think of your colleagues as creative adapters and recognizing that they are 50% of the world. You just happen to be on the 50% where there's more sunshine and less shadow at the moment. But if you think about having creative adaptive colleagues and how you can work with them to the greatest effect, that to me is the most important impact you can have in the short term.
And Eric, I wonder if I could ask you the same question. As somebody who is on the more adaptive end of the scale, how do you see that interaction between adapters and innovators so that they can help each other and work effectively together?
Yeah, I really appreciate what Ewan shared in terms of appreciating what they have and the creative opportunities. Sometimes what people have highlighted is, well, we'll let the innovative folks come up with the ideas and then, you know, the more adaptive folks can make them a reality. And I don't want to sort of create separation of the process, but instead a shared approach. And I think allowing the more adaptive folks to engage in that creative process, I think is really important to get the most of them. And I think you can do that in a way that sort of values their contributions. Probably one of the considerations is making sure that you give them enough time. I think probably at times the more innovative may be frustrated that the adaptive person wants to take time to think about it and ponder. And that may be a challenge along the way. But giving them that space, I think, is really going to allow them to sort of get the most potential benefit.
I would like to express this in terms of three watch-outs that high innovators need to just bear in mind when they're working with more creatively adaptive colleagues. Number one, in terms of the communication method, creative adapters need time to digest. So don't rush and provide written documentation and don't expect people to get it first time. They need time to digest. Number two, compared to innovators, adapters have a preference for working in groups. So they will want to, because it's the group which is the one who is the keeper of the key around structure, and in fact, often the keeper of the conscience. So allow the group to have a conversation. Don't just expect individuals to get stuff first time. The third and final thing is, if you say the structure is wrong, then some adapters may take that as everything in the past that we have done has been undervalued, which has not been the case, because if you wouldn't have had a track record of success, you wouldn't be in a position to have the resources to make the necessary changes. So recognize that the past has been successful, and what we're looking now is shifting the structures because the nature of the problem that we're facing is shifting as well.
You've been listening to the KAI Foundation 5 podcast, part 4, with our special guests, Dr. Ewan Jenkins and Dr. Eric Kaufman. If you found the discussion interesting, you can find out more about the KAI system and its first-class team development potential at www.kaicenter.com. In the meantime, the final part of the KAI Foundation 5 podcast series, Leading Diverse Teams in Uncertain Times, will be along very soon, where we'll be pulling together all the strands of the first four parts and discussing why KAI is so applicable and effective in the real world. So please subscribe and keep listening.